Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Céline Marie Pascal, professor of sociology at American University, about the ideas and the people in her book, Living on the Edge, When Hard Times Become a Way of Life. And you can learn more at cmpascale.org, or follow her on Twitter at cmpascale. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, and more, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. There was a segment on 60 Minutes this past Sunday about China under Xi Jinping. I was struck by the response to Leslie Stahl's final question to the only American she turned to for expertise, Matt Pottinger, President Trump's national security advisor on China, who now writes about China at the Hoover Institution. Following a clip praising China's infrastructure, Stahl asks if Xi is engaged in a campaign to show the rest of the world that their system gets things done and all you get in the West is chaos, is he winning his campaign? Matt Pottinger answers, his campaign is priced primarily on propaganda, right? People know that democracy has outperformed autocracy for the last three centuries. Without endorsing China's political or economic realities, I have to ask, outperformed for whom? For nearly the last five decades, since probably 1973, for the rich, for the wealthiest 10%, 1%, 1/10 of 1%, inequality has grown, the middle class has shrunk, and what Céline Marie Pascal terms the struggle has spread. Pottinger speaks as if the last 50 years, and especially the last 20, haven't happened. As if Wall Street is where Americans live. As if the struggle is not a central feature of our economy and our society. As if the inequality in wealth and power doesn't feed on itself, destined by markets and rules always to grow. Since 2019, the wealth of America's top 1% has jumped a stunning 7 times faster than the net worth of our poorest 50%. Some specifics here. Dollar Tree has registered $1.23 billion in profits over the past year. The CEO personally collected $10,767,000 last year for his services. His workers, the U.S. Senate Budget Committee staff director points out, make as little as $8.32 an hour, and he just announced that due to inflation, Dollar Tree, where millions living on the edge shop, Dollar Tree is raising its prices to 1.25. The current Starbucks CEO, Kevin Johnson, last year took home 1,211 times more compensation than the company's most typical employee, a part-time barista annually making $12,113. In effect, Johnson earned more in compensation before his first morning coffee break of 2020 than the most typical Starbucks employee made from an entire 12 months of labor. Full-time Walmart employees earn between $20,738 and $21,632, less than the $25,149 the Walton family earns in dividends in a single minute. Whole Foods, a subsidiary of Amazon, announced in 2018 that it would cut medical benefits for its entire part-time workforce. The annual saving produced by this was about equal to what Jeff Bezos makes in 2 hours. And, at least as edited, Pottinger ignores the infrastructure comparison entirely. When was the last time the U.S. solved a big problem? The inability to execute big projects like infrastructure bodes poorly for effective and timely responses to epic societal challenges like climate change, as demonstrated by our response to COVID. Céline Marie Pascal is a professor of sociology at American University in Washington, D.C. She's a leader in examining how deep inequalities can be normalized through the language we use or don't use to describe them. And in her book, Living on the Edge, When Hard Times Become a Way of Life, we hear the voices of people who struggle to make ends meet. We see a system that profits from their struggles, and we can make out a vision for change from the working people who know that the economy we have is unsustainable for most of the U.S. population. Welcome, Céline Marie Pascal, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you, Terrence. I'm delighted to be here.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, December 7th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. I offered a brief bio in the intro, but I want to know more about your path. How do you tell your story? Why academia? Why sociology? Why language? And finally, why this book now, which seems to me like a shift of focus for you? And feel free to go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Thank you. Thank you, Terrence. I actually entered graduate school wanting to work on issues of class and economic inequality. My beginning work was on people who couldn't afford housing. But I soon found as a graduate student that the resources available to me as a scholar were really inadequate for addressing the experiences that I knew to be true. So I grew up in an area that was gentrifying. Fields were being turned into a housing development, and my family was displaced from this gentrification when my father became severely disabled from a series of strokes. We moved into a kind of the edge of a very wealthy suburban community, and I had the great fortune of attending good schools, but we struggled just to keep food on the table. My mother held a minimum wage job as a nurse's aide at a state psychiatric institution, and it was tough times for many years. After some of us left home, there were four children and two adults, and when my father passed and a few kids graduated and moved on, things got easier for us. But it took a long time for me to find a path forward, because when I was living hand to mouth, and it was that way for some years, there was no room for thinking about a future. We didn't plan far into the future, and none of us grew up with a sense of careers or career possibilities. So it took a little while for me to find myself. Going to college, you know, was kind of an escape plan because I wouldn't be able to leave home unless I got married, which I didn't want to do. And I had a friend who said, well, you know, what about college? And she might as well have said, what about walking on the moon? I was happy to do it because it seemed like my ticket out of the house. I didn't have any aspiration to be a scholar or any idea of what career paths might open. So I kind of fumbled around as an undergraduate. And then it took 17 years between the time I got my undergraduate degree until I went back to school to get a master's degree and then a doctorate. So it's been a long journey. And why this book now? I'm looking at retirement. I'm toward the end of my career and looking at the country and what's happening. And I wanted to know, now that I have the tools, the intellectual tools, to match my own experiences, I wanted to see what was happening with people in struggling communities. What was life like? Was it as hard as I remembered it? Was it filled with hardship and violence? Was it easier? I had no idea. So I set out to talk with people across the country who are living in communities that have struggled with poverty for decades. And that took me through Appalachia. It took me to Standing Rock and Wind River reservations. And it took me to some very tough neighborhoods in Oakland, where people have been scrapping to get by for a very long time.
Okay. Let me just say one thing that you have said is that growing up, you've just described it was tough and so on, and yet you say that you and your family considered yourselves to be middle class.
Yes, we did.
Looking back from what you know now, what would you say about their class?
Oh, you know, the difficulty is that we don't quite have a language to describe class experience. Mm-hmm. So we use the only language that was available to us. I have never heard people who had housing refer to themselves as poor, right? Everybody thinks that, you know, that they're middle class. More commonly now, they say struggling class. It used to be that people could recognize a working class. But if you weren't holding a blue-collar job, if you didn't have a job in the mines or the mills, then what were you? You know, for that period of my life, people all referred to themselves as middle class, if they referred to themselves by class at all. And so class designations tend to be something assigned to other people, not something we embrace for ourselves. And what moved me so deeply in talking with people is that when they describe themselves as belonging to a struggling class, it was a way they named themselves. It wasn't an academic that came in and said, oh, you're part of the whatever, whatever. But it's how people thought of themselves. And I found that incredibly empowering and quite different from the way that I grew up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said a couple of things about it. One, that it was the way they described themselves. But two, that struggle almost implied hope.
Yes, absolutely. They hadn't given up. And there was often an absolutely impressive amount of unfounded hope that got people from one end of the day to the next. Mm-hmm. The belief that things could be better, would be better, that something would turn up, another shift would become available, that there would be a way forward.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask a couple of questions before we get right in the middle of all this. Any response to my introduction?
I thought it was quite clever of you to draw those connections. And one of the things that we so rarely ask is for whom, when we hear
yes.
information. And that was quite a good insight, an important insight.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, as I watched that moment, which wasn't about this stuff at all, you know, it was about competition with China, but just the way he just said and was not questioned on, you know, everybody knows the U.S. I paraphrase now, but everybody knows the U.S. does great. You know, we're success. And you just realize that it never occurs to Leslie Stahl or perhaps the editors to say, well, wait a minute. You know, you sort of said that you realized I thought it was interesting as you're coming to the end of your career and you had tools to begin to, you know, to go back and look at things you hadn't perhaps looked at and take this opportunity. You tell an anecdote about an interaction you had with a homeless man in the 80s. How does that little nugget fit into this, your choice to go back and talk to people struggling?
I had many interactions with people who were unhoused in the 80s. I think you might be referring to the panhandler that kind of shook me into consciousness around treating people who were panhandling like human beings, even if I wasn't going to give them money, and recognizing that my own family would have been homeless if we were living in the 80s rather than in the 60s. So what's really brought me back, what made this possible, it was an enormous undertaking. The numbers of interviews, the different places, it was huge. And what linked them together was my capacity with research methods that enabled me to do what's called an institutional ethnography. So in the book, I don't try to explain what a group of people think or how it is in this community, but I look at the circumstances of people's lives and then connect those circumstances to the institutions that are predominant in their experiences. So when someone talks about having a toothache but not being able to afford a dental care, she had to take out a medical loan in order to have dental work. I researched those loans in that area to see what the terms were and how people who took them out got trapped in debt. Or when someone needed a car, because struggling families tend to have a very high debt to income ratio because they are low income, and so debt accumulates disproportionately. They qualify primarily for high interest loans. So I looked at high interest car loans in that area to see what would happen. And what I saw by doing that style of an ethnography rather than a classical ethnography, I was, instead of talking about groups of quote unquote other people, I looked at the systems that the United States has created that produce poverty, that generate tremendous profit from poverty, and that keep working people mired in systems they can't escape.
Yeah, what I like about that is that, in other words, you're talking to individuals, they're telling you about their experience, and that's what tells you what you need to research.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
How did you find the people to interview? I will share, by the way, that one of my favorite books over the last few years, and someone who I think did some similar work to you, is Strangers in Their Own Land by Arlie Hochschild, where she spent 5 years in southern Louisiana. So how did you find the people to interview? And then even, how do you break the ice? How do you draw them out?
I met people by hanging around whatever public space I could find, which wasn't very easy in some communities because there's so little public space. People don't have disposable income, so it's not like you could hang out in a cafe or meet people in casual shops. So mostly I met people at farmers markets, you know, talking over jars of pawpaw and handmade quilts, or in casinos or laundromats, in Walmart. I would go to wherever I found people and try to strike up conversations just to get a feel for the place. I talked to a lot of people, housekeeping staff in hotels that I stayed at. And when I found people that seemed willing to talk with me in a formal interview, then I would invite them into that. But I had a lot of relationships with people that were much more casual.
And they don't know your life story. You are a white professor striking up a conversation. What do you think broke the ice and drew people out and made them feel willing to share their stories?
Oh, gosh. I'm not entirely confident of what that was, but here are my best guesses. I had a young man in Oakland, a young African-American man who said to me, he laughed, and he said that, you know, this older white woman just walking up to him and talking to him, starting a conversation, had never happened to him before, and that just because I had done that, he was going to give me some time and talked with me. I met people who absolutely refused to talk to me, as was the case with two Lance women at Standing Rock. And for some reason, that resistance melted away and we had a really profound conversation, couple of conversations. And I think that I explained to people that I wanted to write a book that my own mother would be able to read. And she didn't have a high school education. I felt, I still feel quite done with the scholarly journal of kind of publication, and that I wanted to write for people a book that people could read, the people I was interviewing would be able to read and enjoy, right? They wouldn't feel diminished, they wouldn't feel talked down to, they would have access to it. And I tried to talk about that, and I think that made some headway as well for people. And gosh, I got turned down quite a lot. People who just didn't want anything to do with me. So the hardest place that I had connecting to people, ironically, was in Eastern Kentucky, not in Native communities or Black communities where, you know, Latinx communities where there's, you know, big racial differences that shaped our experiences, but among white people in Eastern Kentucky who had felt done wrong by so many generations of journalists and so much media that they just were not willing to risk ending up on the bad end of that stick again.
Mm-hmm. A couple of things you say. You say this is not the other America that Michael Harrington described in 1962. I certainly remember that book. And you also say this is more than a collection of individual troubles. It's the story of a nation in a deep economic and moral crisis. Can you speak just a little about that?
Sure. I think that when Harrington's book came out, people understood it as some small group, some small number of people who were unfortunate, who had, I think he described a lot of poverty in Appalachia, mm-hmm. where there, it wasn't really America. It was something, some little group within, right?
Yeah.
And what we're looking at now is more than 50% of the population having trouble making ends meet every month. More than 50% of the population not being able to afford unexpected expenses of $400 because right. they just don't have savings. That's an entirely different kind of poverty. And it's an entirely different moral crisis because it's developed as a system where people have become incredibly wealthy because most people are being forced into living on the edge.
Right, right. I think also, I think something of what Michael Harrington was saying when he said the other America was even white people are poor. If we go back to 1962, people knew that people of color were one other. But then what he was saying was even among whites. But as you say, it was a particular geographical section. It was a particular set of circumstances. And now the fact that you're interviewing in the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee, in the coal fields of Kentucky, in southeastern Ohio, on reservations and in Oakland, these are, you know, it's kind of everywhere. How did you choose those places, by the way?
Well, as I said earlier, that I wanted to find communities that had lived in poverty, had sustained poverty for decades.
Mm.
So there is an Appalachian Regional Commission that ranks counties and the level of economic distress they experienced in them. So that was an easy place to find. And certainly Native peoples have been so tremendously marginalized and forced onto reservations where poverty levels, unemployment levels can be 70 or 80%, you know, huge levels of poverty and certainly for generations. And in Oakland, some of the community is really wealthy. They have gorgeous homes and lovely tree-lined streets, and other parts of the community are deep pockets of poverty, and that's where I went. I wanted to have more than rural communities because I think we are connected by these institutions and structures so that even though our personal experience is quite different, it looks quite different in Oakland if you are, you know, having cars stripped down in front of your house and set on fire, than it does in Standing Rock, where you might have to drive 35 miles one way to a grocery store.
Okay, very good. I'm going to take a little bit of time to quote some of the numbers from your book and your article, your recent articles and so on. And then I'll ask you to flesh out sort of how these numbers miss the point or distort the situation and so on. And then with the time remaining, talk about some of the individuals and then finally some of the possible solutions. But let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking today with Céline Marie Pascal, professor of sociology at American University, about the ideas and the people in her book, Living on the Edge, When Hard Times Become a Way of Life. And you can learn more at cmpascal.org, C-M-P-A-S, as in Sam, C-A-L-E, one word, cmpascal.org, or follow her on Twitter, at cmpascal. So, these are some of the numbers that struck me. A recent study by the Brookings Institution defined low-wage work as a median hourly wage of $10.22, and that's $17,950 per year, which is much greater than the federal minimum wage, which is still at $7.25. And by this measure, 44% of all workers in the U.S. are low-wage earners. In 2021, according to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, a worker needs to earn $20.40 per hour to be able to afford a modest one-bedroom apartment anywhere in the country. That's an annual salary of $40,800, more than twice what Brookings refers to as the median wage for low-wage work. Federal data shows that roughly 50% of workers live on less than $35,000 annually. Economic self-sufficiency is a term which many people aren't probably that familiar with. We hear about the poverty line. We hear about unemployment numbers. Economic self-sufficiency is the ability to reliably meet basic needs, including food, housing, transportation, childcare, medical expenses, and other necessities. And in Southeast Ohio, where you did some of your interviews, the self-sufficiency budget provided by the Economic Policy Institute is $34,545, nearly three times the federal poverty line. In San Francisco, the economic self-sufficiency budget would be $69,000. Across the bay in Oakland, it would be $57,000. And remember, the federal poverty line for a single person living anywhere in the U.S. is $12,760. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development considers anyone who pays more than 30% of their income on housing to be cost-burdened. Yet HUD's own figures show that millions of households spend between 50 and 70% of their income on housing. Self-sufficiency for two adults with two children who live in San Francisco, get this, requires an annual income of $148,000, while the federal poverty line for this same family was $25,701. Okay, so one, you can see how many people are struggling. And two, you can see how the numbers we use to talk about it and to not just talk about it, but how to establish who deserves aid and how much aid they deserve and so on are just out of whack. Can you talk a bit about that? And I will tell you this, by the way, Céline Marie, the first thing that got me interested in you and your book was an article that ran in the LA Times about the federal poverty line.
Thank you. Yes. You know, it's a tremendous gap between the rhetoric of poverty and the reality of it. So we think about the federal poverty line as establishing a place where individuals or families fall into economic need. But as you note, when you compare that to self-sufficiency, the gap is extraordinary. The poverty line was set in 1960 by an economist within the government who literally chose what's called a minimum food budget because, and at that time, food was believed to be one third of the family's monthly expenses. So based on the minimum food budget for an individual or a family, and then multiplied that number by three, and that became the poverty line. So there's nothing here that meets reality. And the same is true for the minimum wage, which if the minimum wage had kept pace, we'd be having a minimum wage of
$24 an hour.
$24 an hour, and now it is $7.25.
Yep.
Correct. And we're fighting over trying to get it to $15.
Yep.
So we're still like people, it's tragic. And what's really important to me, and I think to the people in this book, is that the focus isn't just on the people who don't have, but on the people who have so much, precisely because others are made to do without. You know, when we look at someplace like Walmart, that's paying people so little that they actually qualify for and need food stamps, that it's extraordinary. So the government and the taxpayers are subsidizing Walmart by paying food stamps to their workers. And yet we resist creating a stronger social safety net for people.
Yeah. We now, wait, when you
subsidizing
say
subsidizing corporations.
Right. When you say we resist, I always point to the fact that it strikes me that anyone in the Washington, D.C. beltway lives in a different country than the rest of this country. And they talk to each other, and they lobby each other, and they make deals with each other. And you, I'm sure, know very well that the public, as ill-informed as they may be by the press, which parrots these kinds of numbers we're talking about, the public is overwhelmingly in favor of the kinds of safety net improvements that are in the Democrats' reconciliation package. And not to make that partisan, but just to talk about family medical leave, child care, things like this, everyone knows we need those. And yet, within the Beltway, there is that resistance. You actually wrote a piece. we're not going to deal a lot in the politics of it, but you wrote a piece about Joe Manchin, and you said he had written an op-ed, I think, or had just begun to talk about, I got a quote here. He told reporters he would not support the what was then a $3.5 trillion, now it's like $1.75 and still hasn't passed, Build Back Better Act, an investment in the social programs, including public funding for child care and paid family leave and so on, because, quote, I cannot accept our economy or basically our society moving toward an entitlement mentality. And you point out that he's the one with the entitlement mentality.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
As he's speaking from his yacht.
Exactly.
Right.
And as he is ill-representing his own constituents, who, despite the fact that West Virginia is one of the most Republican and one of the most Trump-favoring states, the numbers in West Virginia for the kinds of safety net that we're talking about are very, very high and very, very positive.
That's absolutely true. And there are also communities, counties in West Virginia that, when Trump was running against Clinton and Sanders, 2016 primaries, the counties went overwhelmingly for Sanders. When he didn't make it to the ballot, people stayed home.
Mm-hmm.
So Trump won. So there is a lot of mythology about Trump and the Trumpist movements in who is actually supporting them. A lot of people in the struggling class have been made the face, right? White poverty,
yes,
kind of the face of Trump's movement. But in fact, they're not the people spending, you know, really $70,000 for a dinner with him or a photograph with him. They're not the ones funding his campaign. So the wealthy people who are bankrolling Trump and those like him are being hidden from view, because there is a concerted effort to keep poor white people as the face of that movement. There certainly are poor white people who support Trump, mm-hmm, absolutely. But most of the Trump voters are wealthy, not poor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And certainly the funders are the wealthy ones. And one of the things that I did in the introduction, which you do in the book, is this isn't just look at how poor more people are than you knew in this country, but also as you make clear that there is a system. There have been steps taken. There have been policies between, I think, between government and business that perpetuate and profit from this. Dollar stores, as I pointed out, Walmart, as you pointed out, who their business model depends on people receiving public aid. Payday loans, predatory lenders, these sorts of things. Talk about the industry that lobbies for and profits from the struggling class.
Terrence, it's broad. It's not a single industry. If you think about one of my favorite quotes comes from Robert Reich, who said, if you can't really see how to disentangle corporate interests from government interests, it's because they're one and the same now. It's kind of a rough paraphrase of him. Mm-hmm. But no matter where you look, whether it is recently, the Sacklers have been all over media, right, because of the OxyContin suits. Mm-hmm. And they have, coming off the top of my head, something like 2 lobbyists for every member of Congress. They've spent millions upon millions to protect their industry at the expense of people. And it's been extraordinary, the damage that they've been able to do. So in 2001, sales of OxyContin were up by 80%. They were the mainstay of Purdue's revenue. And in Mingo County, West Virginia, there were just 3 small pharmacies in towns that had populations under 3,000 that received a total of 30 million opioid pills from distributors. So that's not just the pharmaceutical company, but that's also distributors and pharmacists. And there's an entire industry that's being protected by the lobbyists, by the way that the DEA was constrained from actually investigating the whole opioid catastrophe that struck the country, right?
And the way that when Medicare Part D was passed in the Bush administration, the Medicare is not allowed to negotiate prices with the pharmaceutical industry based on volume, which of course is the way that we would get reasonable prices. And in fact, Kristen Sinema has taken a great deal of money from the pharmaceutical industry to oppose that because it's finally in the Build Back Better bill, but may not make it because of the opposition of someone who has received a great deal of funding from them. And one thing I want to point out is that when people hear that small pharmacies in small towns in West Virginia had millions of pills, it does not just mean that people in those towns were gobbling up, you know, them by the thousands. It also means that they were functioning as basically drug dealers, that you could come from somewhere else and go into those pharmacies and pick up your OxyContin.
Exactly. Thank you for pointing that out. You're absolutely right. Yeah. It's far, you know, the numbers of pills, it's far too many for any.
Yeah. No matter how addicted the entire town might have been, they couldn't have swallowed that many pills.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about there is that industries we may not think of profit from this struggling class. And one other thing that I was really struck by, and it was just a little, you know, a little note, that when the government is figuring out the poverty line, they do not include debt as an expense, or when they're figuring out all sorts of things. And yet, as we know, if you have a medical bill, if you have a car repair, you are probably, if you're living day to day and paycheck to paycheck, are going to go into debt. And so that then becomes a significant part of the daily fear you live under and the stress you live under and the anxiety you live under, but actually your financial situation.
Exactly. And once you get into that loop, it's very hard to get out. So There is a story in the book about a woman at Standing Rock who ended up having to take out, I believe it was a payday loan. She got caught in that. She, like anyone taking out a payday loan, you think, oh, you know, I can figure this out. I'll pay it back on my next check. But if you had the money to pay it back, you wouldn't need the loan to begin with. Well, it was even worse for her because she lost her job before the payday loan came due. And then she had nothing, right? And it sounds like, well, how in the world can you make money doing that, right? Why would you want to lend money to people who are unlikely to pay it back? That's exactly what makes it so profitable. So she ended up in court, and the typical offer is either we're going to take your assets or we will take your pay when you...
Oh, my God, yeah.
When she gets a job. With her only asset, as is the case for most people in the struggling class, is their vehicle. So she can't give that up. She's very happy that they let her keep her car. And when she gets her pay, at her next time she gets hired, before she gets any money from her employer, a chunk of that goes to paying back the payday loan, which has been accruing interest. So she's stuck in a cycle that's going to take a very, very long time to get out of.
Yeah. So now you've just done it by that illustration, but I was going to say, tell us a few of the individual circumstances, situations, and so on. So that was a woman from Standing Rock. You've got the Southeast Ohio, West Virginia area. You've got Oakland. Tell us about a few of the individual stories, if you could, for the next 5 minutes or so.
I think perhaps Michael Chase in Southeast Ohio exemplifies some of the ways that people misunderstand what it means to live in poverty, what it means to struggle. He's someone who was earning, I think, less than $16,000 a year, working two jobs, and having to live with roommates because he couldn't afford a place on his own. Yet he didn't think of himself as being poor, and by the government, a federal definition of poverty, he was well above the poverty line, which was 12,000 something at the time. And yet he couldn't make ends meet. And it helps the whole national discourse around poverty when Michael and those like him say, well, no, I'm not poor. People who are poor don't have running water. They don't have food for their children. And certainly a lot of people live like that. Not having running water should be impossible in the United States. And it's not. It's quite common in some areas. So for Michael to think of himself as not poor, then what does that do? It kind of distorts that whole national conversation about wealth and inequality. So I think his experience, he had his two jobs, he left them, went back to school, moved in with his parents, got three certificates to do healthcare work, and at the end of that was making $10 or $12 an hour. So he couldn't, low-wage work doesn't offer you a path out of poverty. You know, and it's very hard in many of these regions. The only kind of work that exists is low-wage work.
And, I mean, a subject that we will not have time to cover, but the, I think, surprising thing that's happening now, where people lost their jobs in the pandemic and have decided, I can't go back to that low-wage job that was stealing my life and not giving me a living. And I, like I say, it's something which has surprised me. I think it has surprised most people. And we don't know yet how that story is going to unfold. But you can see that the people that you're talking about, that job that they lost is not inviting. It's not, as you say, it does not provide a path to a better future. It just provides a path to this Saturday and next Saturday, and the Saturday after that is about as far as it goes. So that's Michael Chase in Southeast Ohio. And a couple of things I want to mention about his case. He works 45 to 60 hours a week with those two jobs, brings homes under 16,000, and of course, does not have health insurance, sick leave, or vacation. And I think that last thing about what people don't have in those low-wage and part-time jobs, and often those multiple low-wage and part-time jobs, are the things that a truly middle-class life just takes for granted. Someone in Standing Rock, perhaps Erica.
Mm-hmm. Erica is a woman who had a college education, had done some international travel, had a professional job, and her family circumstances were such that she ended up needing to care for her nieces when her sister developed substance abuse issues. And because she had these nieces in her apartment with her, eventually a new apartment manager came on and decided that she had to leave, that he wanted proof that she actually had guardianship of the children. And in Standing Rock, it doesn't really work that way. You know, mm-hmm. you could really just raise someone's kids because you're family, you know, mm-hmm. you can do that. So Erica filed for adoption papers to say that she had legal custody of the children. But before that came through, she ended up being evicted. So on the streets with four children and lost her job, ended up in a shelter and really was struggling to get her feet under her. They ended up having to leave the shelter because it was a temporary shelter, right? And they went to live in the basement of her sister's house, and it was pretty catastrophic for the kids as well as for Erica. One of the daughters ended up being raped. There was an enormous crisis around most of communities of color. Women have a hard time reporting crimes by men of color because the system treats them so badly. The whole system, the racism in the criminal justice system, often prevents women of color from reporting crimes. But for Erica, this was so egregious. She reported the man who raped her niece. He was taken to prison. They became exiled from their community because people were bitter that she had turned in this man. And they just were really hand to mouth for a very, very long time. I'm pleased to say, I'm kind of glad you asked about it, because when the book came out, I sent a copy of it to her. And she wrote back saying that she was so excited that she found some people who were able to help her and the girls get out of that living situation that they were in. And they got some childcare. She got to go back to work, and they were living in a much more stable place than when we had talked. So that was a great piece of good news that I didn't expect to find.
Right. Oakland, California, Vanessa Torres. And what you say that's interesting in her story is you find out in talking to her that she has $20,000 in savings. And at that moment you think, well, she doesn't fit. No use interviewing her. And then you find out the actual circumstances. And could you talk about that and what it means about population like hers?
Sure. I learned a lot in the book, all in the course of researching the book and talking to people. So when I was interviewing people with low-wage jobs, so even Erica, who's doing well now, is still a low-wage worker. When I found someone who had $20,000 in the bank, it's not a low-wage worker. Low-wage workers don't accumulate that kind of savings. And what she was able to explain to me that I hadn't seen is that she was the only person in her family who had a good Social Security number. She was a DACA recipient. So she was the person in the family who could have steady work. And that was a life support, because the family, I don't remember the exact years, but they had been in the country maybe 20 years, mm-hmm. something like that, and applied for citizenship, and their papers were still being processed. So she was, you know, like they'd done everything they could. They tried to play by the rules, but it just wasn't happening. They came to the country. She has been holding down the fort. Her family could be deported at any time. And so there's always that stress of not knowing what will happen to her parents or siblings that she would need to care for if her parents were deported. That savings was not the usual way I think of savings, right? It really was a lifeline. Mm-hmm. And then when the pandemic hit, her parents, her mother had sold tamales on street corners and her father was working in construction. Both became unemployed and unable to get any kind of benefits. So she became responsible for them and for her siblings. So there is a level of precarity that pervades even the most stable positions, right? If you're working in, if you're an immigrant working in communities where so many relatives are faced with possible deportation. And that's another place where corporations bring in, they depend upon immigrant undocumented labor and then send them, you know, the deportation process that sends them back is part of a revolving door that has been part of the U.S. economy for, I don't know, more than 100 years.
Yeah, I was thinking as you were speaking that one of the things that I think this book illuminates is that we have impressions, we have myths that we go along with that turn out, as you scratch below the surface, to be untrue. And I think we think that, oh, those anti-immigrant policies is Trump coming down an escalator saying that Mexicans are rapists, and it's those racist and xenophobic folks who do. Whereas in fact, corporations, as you just pointed out, the precariousness of undocumented serves their interests. It's not just individuals with racist attitudes.
That's right. Our economy runs on that kind of exploitation.
So it's not just that they might do hard work for low wages, but that their precariousness keeps them from organizing, standing up to you. And if they're easily replaced, then that revolving door you talk about works fine for the corporation and horribly for the human beings.
Right. The undocumented status creates a flexible, docile workforce for exploitative employers.
Yeah. Okay, how do we get out of this? What are the solutions? And I will say one of your last sections of the book you call Reckoning and Repair. And I thought that was a good phrase because reckoning means facing it and knowing about it, where people actually know this is what's so, and only then can you begin to repair.
Right. Many people have told me that they find the book challenging to read because they didn't know that there was this level of hardship. And I think that speaks to the levels of segregation that we have, economic segregation, as well as racial segregation in the country, where these experiences are not, they're common for millions of people, but still unknown to others. Mm-hmm. So that is part of the reckoning. But I think a larger piece of this is understanding that the wonderful quote from Bryan Stevenson, you know, the opposite of poverty is not wealth, it's justice. And we're facing these intersecting crises of inequality that include affordable housing, access to health care, civil rights. And then we have this amazing climate crisis that we're living through and a pandemic, right? So all of these are kind of, they're intersecting. It's the same ball of yarn that we're trying to work with here. And in order to get at the core issues that are keeping so many people in unstable and unlivable situations, we need to have some basic governmental reform. Most of the people that I talked to understood the problem as democracy, that they were being severely disenfranchised because government and corporate interests were one. And the corporate interests were the ones driving them into poverty, holding them in poverty. So there are some basic steps. One, I think a representational democracy where there's one person, one vote get rid of the Electoral College system, to make all elections publicly funded, to get big money out of elections so that politicians absolutely are beholden to their voters, unlike what we're seeing with Manchin and Sinema. And actually, they're just the extreme people at this moment. It's typically that way. To have truly free and fair elections where people, I don't know if it's a national voting day, but where people are encouraged and enabled to come and vote. And then to have a logical districting based on geography that kind of sets right all these decades of gerrymandering that we've had. So I think that once we have a government that actually works for the people instead of the corporations, we can make the changes that people feel need to be made because politicians will work in their best interests, which we're such a long way from that. So those are kind of the broad brushes, I think, of that last chapter, moving into a greater democracy.
I think it's interesting, by the way, that it isn't that you say we need this health program or this food program or this housing program. What you're saying is that we will not get programs that work for these millions, these 44%, this 50% of people who are struggling if we don't have democracy. And I so know that that is the truth. And of course, right now, that fragile democracy is if anything, heading in the wrong direction. If we cannot get the For the People Act passed, then the gerrymandering that is going on in the states is going to perpetuate this for at least another decade. I speak a lot on this program, Salim Marie, about minority rule and what has happened in the distortion of our country, where we now live under minority rule, and minority rule has the power to perpetuate itself. And this is a crisis not only of the immediate results, but of the it's a cancer that will eat away at even the hope for democracy. So again, the book is Living on the Edge, When Hard Times Become a Way of Life. The website is cmpascal.org. That's C-M-P-A-S as in Sam, C-A-L-E. cmpascal.org. Or you can follow Celine Marie on Twitter at cmpascal. At CM Pascal. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of guests and issues, plus usually 10 or so articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and most major podcast sites. And you'll find years of podcasts at my site or at those sites. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Keanu Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Celine Marie Pascal. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence. It's a pleasure.